This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Denby is the film critic for The New Yorker magazine. He's been writing about movies since 1969. I'm sure I wasn't the only one of his readers who was surprised by the subject of his new memoir, his adventures investing in the stock market. The book is only partially about his wild ride in the market, buying high-tech stocks at the height of the bubble. Much of the story is about how his life changed when his wife left him. Their separation is what led him to invest so heavily in the market. Taking on the risks of investing helped rouse him out of despair, but it only increased what he describes as the bizarre torment of our age, the constant need to keep up, and the overwhelming sensation of never staying on top of things. Denby's new book is called American Sucker. I asked him to describe the changes in his life that made him feel like he needed more money and the way to get it was through the market.
It was 99, and my wife, Kathleen Shine, a novelist, and I were splitting up, and I was, I think, grief-struck is the proper word. And one of the things I wanted to do, I mean, it was a very amiable and amicable partner, but she was going off in search of a new life, and it was no way I could argue her to change her mind. So one of the things I wanted to do after we finally parted and was to earn enough money to buy her out of our apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which is a place at 76th Street in West End. Nothing special about it. I mean, it was a nice piece of turf in Manhattan, and everyone knows what that is worth. But, you know, it was an ordinary place on the second floor. The light wasn't so good. Many, I think, middle-class people have more light and space than we did. But anyway, I needed to raise a lot of money to buy her out, and the market was booming. It was late 99, early 2000, the peak of what is now known as the bubble. And I got caught up in that euphoria. My initial intention, of course, I suppose, was rational, to make money to buy out my wife's share of an apartment. I got caught up in the tech boom, which had been roaring along for almost 5 years. And with Kathy's permission, I threw it seems almost impossible to imagine, about 80% of our liquid assets into the tech end of the market just before it started to burst. And people around the magazine at the New Yorker noticed that I was obsessional, and a brilliant editor there, Henry Finder, said, "Keep a journal."
Why the stock market? When you thought, okay, I need money, my life's falling apart, my wife's leaving, I've got two sons, I want to buy her out of the apartment so that I can continue to live there. Why the stock market as opposed to let me land that really big book advance, or maybe I can get another job or a big raise at the New Yorker?
Well, I was working hard for the New Yorker, doing movie reviews and longer pieces, and the market was going up. You know, the Nasdaq was climbing a couple percent every week, and it seemed like we were creating new wealth. It's very hard now to recall that euphoria of 4 years ago, but it seemed like hundreds of billions of dollars of new wealth were being created out of nowhere, and it seemed the fastest way. We had been doing okay in the market. I was never, obsessed with it or anything, but just in a kind of conservative balancing, diversifying, the usual common sense wisdom. All through the 90s, we had been doing fine. And so there was a pile of usable assets sitting around. And that seemed like the quickest way to employ them. I did eventually get a book contract, so that helped through the rough periods a little bit. One of the things that happened was I attached myself to people who, I was looking for gurus who knew something. I didn't know much, so I liked plunging into a situation teaching myself. I'm an outsider. I mean, I did a book 7 years ago, but going back and reading the Western classics at Columbia, I love just throwing myself into something and as a non-pro and seeing if I can figure out how the turf works. So I was running around New York going to investor conferences and attaching myself to people I thought who were interesting and who would lead me into the technological future and also make me wealthy. And two of them turned out to be scoundrels. And one is Sam Waxel, Martha Stewart's friend, who's now languishing in federal prison in central Pennsylvania for 7 years. And the other is Henry Blodgett, the Merrill Lynch internet analyst who's been banned from Wall Street for life and fined $4 million by Elliot Spitzer.
Are you angry with them for suckering you?
They did not urge me to invest in anything in particular, so I cannot hold them responsible for my follies. But they were certainly part of this enormous delusion of that period. And, you know, I labor over this question a great deal in the book. Was he a conscious swindler and scoundrel, or was he just a fantasist who just wanted the glory so much? He had these series of social intellectual evenings at his loft in Soho in Manhattan, to which I began going, and they were very pleasant nights and for a few privileged people. Sam was trying to, you know, fulfill the old dream of the salon, to bring together people with power and money, with people who have ideas and people who write, artists, and so on. And there would be good food and good drink, and everyone would mill around and talk, and then someone would give a little talk on something, and there'd be wonderful arguments. He was incredibly charming, and is incredibly charming. So he conned a lot of people for years.
As a film critic, one of the things that you do is study character. Now, they're fictional characters. But
right.
You're always kind of studying character and reading between the lines.
Why didn't I read his lines?
Well, it's different in real life, isn't it? But did you feel like you should have seen something?
Well, I saw the hustling, certainly. I saw the way he would flatter people, including me, and although I couldn't do him any good, but he still does that habitually. But, you know, all the biotech entrepreneurs do the same thing, because it takes 10, 12 years to get the drug through clinical trials and then pass the FDA. So they're out there like Burt Lancaster in The Rainmaker, holding up their arms, you know, and saying, just believe it's going to rain sooner or later, telling their story over and over again. It's not just Sam who did it. He did it perhaps in a more manic way than other people, but he got very serious people to believe in him. You know, Carl Icahn, the corporate raider, and Pete Peterson, former Secretary of Commerce, and Ehud Barak, and Bill Clinton. I mean, a lot of people thought, you know, that he was terrific. And of course, as I say, the drug does work, but at the same time, he was pulling various fast ones and swindles and pleaded guilty to 6 federal charges.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Denby. He's film critic for The New Yorker magazine. His new book, American Sucker, is about the period when he invested kind of obsessively in the stock market. And unfortunately for him, it was during the height of the bubble. So it didn't turn out the way he was hoping.
We lost quite a bit on paper or on screen.
How much did you lose on paper?
Well, I think on paper we lost $800,000 at the worst time. Now, this is what happened, Terry. The minor holdings were in tech stocks, and I sold them out near the bottom, I'm sorry to say. But I held on to the funds, which were the major holdings, and they have come back quite a lot since October 2002, which was the bottom. The NASDAQ composite index is up 80% since then. So if you get kicked in the stomach, or you kick yourself in the stomach, in my case, and then you get out altogether, you're just being stupid twice. In other words, you miss the recovery. So, I haven't made up our losses, but I've minimized them. Let's put it that way.
How much real money did you lose?
Well, I think I finally totaled it up on what Kathy and I had invested all through the 90s, and then where we were about a year ago, and it actually came out about even. So, in that respect, it was all paper gain and paper loss, or screen gain and screen loss. I mean, classic bubble activity.
My guest is David Denby. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Denby, film critic for The New Yorker and author of the new memoir American Sucker, which is about being heavily invested in the stock market at the height of the bubble and being quite obsessive about those investments. At what point did you realize you were becoming kind of obsessive about investing?
Oh, right there at the beginning, exactly 4 years ago, the beginning of 2000, I'd get up in the morning, turn on CNBC, you know, watch it through breakfast and, you know, try to figure out what in the world they were talking about, listen to all of these CEOs and stock analysts lay out their goods on a blanket, you know, and so try to hawk them in the bazaar. I mean, they now have to be much more forthcoming about what stocks they hold and what they own and their own interests because of all the scandals. But I was fascinated by it, and then I began to read, and I read a lot of literature around it, and I wound up cutting it out of the book because it's impeded the narrative. But I had a lot of fiction in there, Dreiser and Edith Wharton and Fitzgerald and Trollope. I felt like actually like Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby looking at someone like Sam at his parties. I mean, he was very much like Gatsby, and I was like Nick Carraway, the observer, with his face pressed up to the window.
Why was the market a good fit for your obsessive needs? I mean, obviously you wanted to make some money in it, but it was fulfilling something else in your life, too.
Well, I think I'm probably obsessional by nature, and you know, and I have hobbies. Whatever I'm writing about, I like to plunge in, as I say, and immerse myself in something, pile up a lot of books around me, of which I read maybe a third. But it feels good to try to master something. But to answer the question psychologically, I was lonely and upset and needed, you know, something to keep the blood pumping in that down period of my life. And I came out of it. What can I say? I'm in love again. So if you have to put one foot after the other and get the worst thing you can do if you're having a terrible period is to globalize your despair, you know, and fall into Weltschmerz. And if you just say, let's see, I have to shop in the afternoon and work with the kids, work with my son on his biology exam and in the evening, and I have to watch a movie tomorrow morning. In other words, like that, one foot after another.
Being a kind of obsessive personality, how do you think that your obsessive nature affected your ability to handle the separation from your wife when she decided that she wanted to leave the marriage?
It didn't. It was totally amicable, and we have two sons and to take care of, and we're both non-confrontational. One of the things I did was swallow my anger because I hate these men who wander around talking about, you know, how awful women are. It's total nonsense. So we remained friends throughout this whole thing, and you know, we talk every day now. So the last thing I wanted to be was a guy carrying his divorce papers around and arguing for himself in court. We did the whole thing through mediation, and it took a long time because I didn't want to sell the apartment. I suppose we should give that part of the plot away. I finally realized it was insane to hold on to the apartment and sold it at last after holding on to it for a couple of years. There was something strange about that, Terry. I mean, as I said, it's a nice piece of turf, but nothing special. But I just couldn't face the thought of leaving it. And I was 57, whatever I was, 58. And I think, you know, I finally realized that I'm afraid I'm going to die if I leave this apartment. I know it sounds a little bit nuts. But this is a kind of middle-aged craziness, that a kind of panic. You realize you're not going to have an infinite number of days. And the apartment somehow became symbolic of my life ending. Well, of course, it's complete nonsense. And I finally realized it. But I think that's why I so much wanted to hold on to it. And it was home, of course, where we had raised two children. And there, you know, for two writers to have 5,000 books and a personal relation with each one of them, to split those books up was a minor trauma in itself, like each one is a friend.
Oh, here's an important question. This time around, I know you have a girlfriend now. I don't know if you're living together, but have you mixed your books together or kept them separately?
We have not yet mixed our books together, but it is in the offing. She's a great reader. So I don't know how we're gonna you know, fit all of these things together.
Do you have this, you know,
enough book space?
Do you feel like you should never mix your books again in case you separate?
No, you have to mix your books. All true relations depend on mixed books, because the books communicate to one another and to you, and you know, it's part of the family.
Do you have a different set of standards for mixing bank accounts than for mixing books, or is it the same standard?
I think married couples should certainly have a common bank account, and I still have one with my ex-wife because we have to pay for the children's school bills, and so we each contribute to this bank account in equal amounts, and then, you know, pay the school bills and the clothing and so on. Yes, I believe it. If you're married, for God's sakes, be married.
Oh, I have a question about your divorce, and you just let me know if this is too personal.
Okay.
Okay. When your wife left you, it was, I think, in part or largely because she realized she wanted to be with another woman.
Yes. I never wrote about that in the book because I thought it wasn't really part of my story, and it was her business to tell that if she wanted to. And she has told it in a variety of ways and is perfectly open about it. And as a matter of fact, I'm good friends with her partner, who's a totally wonderful person. I admit I didn't speak to her for a year, but we all get along quite well. So I thought that was Kathy's business. If she wants to talk about it, you know, it's up to her.
When your marriage ended, and you write about this in the book, you went through a period of obsessively looking at pornography.
It lasted a few weeks, yes, once the summer after Kathy shipped out. And I think I put it in there, even though I know it would upset some people, because it's a common experience. God, I don't know any man who hasn't turned on the internet and looked at, you know, a few times. And I think the stock market obsession which followed pulled me out of that cave. Although I do still hear occasionally from, you know, women like Heather. There's the great Heather who sends out messages to so many people she's so close to. that long ago, that obsession vanished. It's really pretty boring after the first glimpse.
After you know, spending a few weeks watching a lot of the porn websites, did you find yourself seeing love scenes in movies any differently?
No, because the whole thing about pornography, right, is that the people are, you don't know, it's completely impersonal. When I don't want to see famous actors naked because I have very direct relations with them, you know, in my head of a different kind. And they are really spiritual presences. And what I, you know, sometimes in the old days, in the 40s, when there was no nudity, that Hepburn and Tracy would just look at each other and you'd say, you know, oh my God, wow, it's happening. They're going to do it. You know, it was much, in a way, more exciting. So I'm sort of don't really want explicit sexual scenes, particularly. I can't conceive of many times in which it's been well done. Although you need it in Cold Mountain when Jude Law finally gets home to Nicole Kidman. You needed something there because the whole movie is tending towards the two lovers finally getting back together. That there, I thought it was fine. It was dramatically justified. Pornography is a whole other kind of terrible experience, furtive, you know. It's not the same thing.
Did taking risks in the market lead you to take more risks in other aspects of your life?
No, certainly. I don't think so. Maybe in my writing. I mean, this book is a risk in the sense that I'm exposing, you know, a period of money lust, and intellectuals are not supposed to do that. In fact, in my experience, intellectuals are as much concerned with money and status as anyone else. It's just that they don't talk about it. It's considered beneath one's dignity.
But to talk about money?
Although you can hear it underneath, I do talk about consumer desires. I fell in love with an automobile, a very peculiar event. Standing there in Rockefeller Center and was sort of struck dumb by an Audi A6. I'd never had a thing about cars before. And so I go into this whole, you know, the whole consumer quandary. Are we losing our souls to consumption?
This is a $42,000 car you're talking
about.
It
is a very expensive, very beautiful car. I did drive it. I went over and, you know, and grabbed one from the dealer in New York, and I had a grand total of 20 minutes with it because another customer was coming, and I drove it wildly up the West Side Highway and turned around and drove it wildly back to the dealer. And it is a marvelous thing. I don't think there's anything corrupting about one or two desires for luxury. Everyone has something they're crazy about. But consumption as a way of life is corrupting, but I'm very sympathetic because I think the real problem is that most, and this is very hard to say, most people's work isn't very exciting, and so if they're dreaming about SUVs while they're sitting stoned at a computer screen, they have my total sympathy.
You say that, you know, intellectuals aren't supposed to be that absorbed in money, but, you know, here you are really writing about it. But everybody has a line that they draw that they won't go over in terms of talking about money. I mean, for instance, your whole book is about your investments in the stock market. But if I asked you, how much does the New Yorker pay you every week? Or how much did they give you for your book advance?
You probably wouldn't
want to talk about that, right?
No, I wouldn't. That really is private stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't expect you to answer that, but I mean, you two still have the line that you'll draw up about talking about money.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. And I certainly wouldn't rant on about the stock market to anyone who wasn't interested, because there's nothing more boring than hearing someone else's obsession that is irrelevant to you.
David Denby is a film critic for The New Yorker. His new memoir is called American Sucker. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Denby. He's a film critic for The New Yorker. His new memoir is about how his life changed when his wife left him, and in the hopes of buying out her half of their home, he invested heavily in the stock market at the height of the bubble. The book is called American Sucker. You've probably seen all the gambling movies. Right? And, you know, in gambling movies, unless it's a comedy, the person almost always loses.
That's a good point. And when I was writing this, I was thinking of, not to compare myself in terms of talent, but just obsession, I was thinking of Dostoevsky's short novel, The Gambler, which he wrote in 6 weeks to satisfy a publisher who was gouging him. And that really, as well as anything I can think of, captures the whole madness, the obsessional, the rushing towards the abyss. Even as you know, you're going over the abyss. I did pull myself back, though.
But I'm wondering if these movies or if the Dostoevsky story came to your mind as you were getting deeper and deeper.
Oh, sure. And I was searching around, you know, for analogs to my experience. Trollope's novel, The Way We Live Now, which is written, I think, 1878, which is about how capitalism hits London, and there's a scoundrel at the center of it named Melmotte. Who cons everyone and takes their money and sets up a paper company to build a ridiculous railroad and never actually lays down a single tie. That one was very powerful because everyone around him sort of changed their behavior in relation to him and relation to each other. It's a brilliant, brilliant novel. I think it's probably the greatest Victorian novel and still isn't as nearly well known as it should be.
You started reviewing movies in 1969. Do you think that was a particularly good time to start?
It was a fantastic time. It was just beginning to happen. I remember Easy Rider had come out that summer, and then MASH, Robert Altman's MASH. And what happened was the studios they overestimated the size of the youth audience. Remember youth, when everyone took youth very seriously. Well, I was a youth in those days. They overestimated the size of the counterculture and the radical audience, and they said, we don't know how to make movies for these kids. But there are these young directors coming out of film school. They're immersed in film. I don't know, one of them's name is Spielberg or something like that. And, you know, Scorsese and De Palma and Ashby and this guy Altman and so on. And they gave the directors free rein for a while. And we had a golden era there. I think the bitterness of the Vietnam period got absorbed and calmed down a little bit. The movies of the 60s are too jumpy and zeitgeisty for me, but by the 70s, you know, you get to The Godfather and Chinatown and Shampoo and Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller and so on, and you're getting a string of masterpieces from the American studio system that were, I think, far richer than American movies had ever been up to that point. Well, it ran out of gas, as we all know. By the middle 80s, it was beginning to be obvious to me that, you know, the marketing was running the whole thing, and an audience research and so on. And then, Terry, the way movies open now is just a disaster. I mean, it's so much part of the whole scene that no one even thinks it's strange anymore. But movies open at 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 screens on Friday. And by Saturday or Sunday, they know whether or not it's going to be a success. And then they either expand the run or contract it because television advertising is so expensive. So what do? If that's the box you've put yourself into, you make movies for people who will go on opening weekend. So that means that boys aged 15 to 25, including young men, exercise a influence on what movies get made way out of proportion to their numbers in the population, even in the movie-going population. And that's why there are so many thrillers, and that's why there are so many fantasy movies and so many characterless films.
Do you think the movie industry is being stupid or misguided? I mean, do you think, like, in your opinion, are they dumb or are they just kind of, misguided?
They're dumb and cynical and you know, in many ways, and they don't trust artists. They trust their marketing people much more, even though the marketing projections fail over and over again. They're actually a little panicked at the moment because attendance was off a few percent last year, and they're blaming it on piracy, which I think, you know, is absurd. The obvious problem is most of the movies were terrible.
I know you're very frustrated with a lot of the movies that get released now. Do you think it's changing film criticism? You know, when you started reviewing movies, there's not only the whole new generation of film directors that you were talking about, you know, Spielberg, Scorsese, De Palma, but there was also still a lot of, like, European films that were...
Absolutely.
You know, very, very groundbreaking for their time. And, you know, Truffaut and Godard were still active. Still making great movies. So I'm wondering if you think that the state of film criticism, in your opinion, has been affected by the state of movies.
Well, it's sort of like criticism is running on two tracks. There's a whole generation of what you'd have to call hack critics who have been created, in effect, by this distribution pattern that I'm talking about. And, you know, when you open the paper on Sunday, wherever you are in this country, and you see an ad for a movie that's opening the following Friday, and it's already garlanded with masterpiece quotes around the title, you have to wonder, what is that? Are they reviewing this movie 10 days or 2 weeks before the opening? Well, what it is that they've been sent to a junket, either to Los Angeles or to New York. And, you know, if you're a critic in the Midwest or somewhere, or the Southwest, or anywhere, actually, you can go 25 weekends a year and spend very nice time at a hotel, whining and dining. You get to see the movie, you get to spend 5 minutes with Tom, or with Julia, or with Jack, and then you write that up, and then Sunday morning you trot down to the publicist's office, and as a kind of quid pro quo, you give a masterpiece quote. Those quotes are not excerpted from reviews that have already been given. The movie hasn't opened yet, so... There's that. And the serious people have been drowned in other words, many of the critics have been sort of co-opted and moved into the promotional activity for movies. And it's the fault of editors at newspapers who want that kind of piece in their newspaper and don't say to their critics, don't do that, it's corrupting, no one's going to trust you. That's what they should be saying. So there's that. And then there's the serious critics who... you know, are sort of marginalized and manipulated, and we're kept out of screenings. I mean, it's still a great job. I don't mean to introduce a note of self-pity here, and eventually we get our say. But they're pushing us around as much as possible, and there's this weird schizophrenia. On the one hand, they will always tell anyone who asks that critics have no power. On the other hand, they never lose any opportunity to, you know, make us feel small, push us around, marginalize us, keep us out of screenings to the last second or afterwards, whatever. So it still matters to some degree, commercially.
What are some of the ways in which you feel you are pushed around by the movie industry?
You'll hear that, you know, you want to see a film so you can get it in your magazine on time, and then they say, oh, no, there's no print in town. This is in New York. And then you hear that so-and-so saw the movie last night, and this or that group saw it the night before.
They're afraid you're going to dislike it and give it a bad review.
That's because of what I described before, that it's all tending to, the whole promotional effort tends towards that opening weekend when the thing opens at 5,000 screens, even though they're telling everyone critics don't have any power. They're terrified. Here's, you know, there's some crumb bum living on the Upper West Side of New York, some overeducated jerk is going to affect their $80 million investment. Don't forget, ordinary movies cost $60 million coming out of Hollywood, another 30 for promotion. You have to double that in terms of box office to begin to break even. So each of these things, no matter how trivial it is as a movie, is an enormous gamble. So if there's anyone, you know, who can hurt their investment in any way, they want to minimize that person's importance. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have an effect on reputations. Mm-hmm. We do. And we may have an effect on the awards, but, you know, and you have that weird thing at the Oscars where they're all rewarding, some, in many cases, smaller, independently made films. You know, they hate it, but they do it anyway, and then it has nothing to do with their practice the rest of the year.
What are some of the movies you grew up with that made you fall in love with movies?
No one remembers now, but commercial television in the 50s was a kind of revival house.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Marshall McLuhan used to say that the last medium becomes the content of the next one. So the content of television in the early 50s was movies for the most part. Of course, there was Ed Sullivan and variety shows, quiz shows, game shows, but a lot of it was movies. And so I would, you know, watch King Kong and the Marx Brothers and Fred and Ginger and John Wayne and over again. And then when I was at college, I remember going to, you know, walking to a revival house in Manhattan that was not far from Columbia, and sitting there in this horrifying theater where your feet stuck to the floor and your neck ached after an hour and watching two movies from the 30s by Renoir or two Marx Brothers movies. And that was great. It was a big part of my education. And then I lucked into, as I said, this wonderful period in the 70s. So what worries me, Terry, is that a lot, and not just movies, but a lot of minority culture choices, jazz, classical music, folk music, old movies, documentaries, foreign films, could simply disappear. If everything's digitized and we can download it through the internet, everyone has fast access, broadband access, that's fine. That would be a solution. We could look at things on a decent-sized screen, play them on our music systems, but if that continues to happen slowly, I'm afraid that a lot of things will simply disappear, because I don't trust Blockbuster and Tower to continue to give huge acreage to these minority tastes, which are generating such small amounts of revenue. So this kind of thing has happened. Bill Gates bought a great photograph archive, the Bettman Archive, buried it in a mine shaft outside of Pennsylvania. Now nobody can get to it, and supposedly they're going to digitize it, but they really haven't. And the same thing could happen with certain kinds of cultural goods that you and I took for granted and older listeners took for granted, but that might not be available to our children. That scares me a lot.
David Denby, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
David Denby is a film critic for The New Yorker. His new memoir is called American Sucker.